is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. President Rouhani warns that Iranians will not forget the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and that they'll take revenge at an appropriate time. UN human rights experts say the U.S. president's pardon for four Blackwater contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 is an affront to justice. And more than 3,900 Americans die of COVID-19 in the past 24 hours. As total infections in the world's worst hit country inch closer to 20 million. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the nation will not forget the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani on the first anniversary of his martyrdom.
We will never forget the assassination of General Soleimani. It was a great tragedy. We will always be mourning for him, as well as for Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The Iranian nation and countries in the region will avenge their killing at an appropriate time.
Rouhani also slammed the U.S. for the, quote, savage assassination, and denounced President Donald Trump for personally ordering the killing. The Iranian president hailed General Soleimani for his role in bringing peace and security to the region. He said Soleimani was a source of pride for Muslims as he brought dignity to regional countries and beyond. Joining us now from the Iranian capital, Tehran, we have Professor of World Studies at University of Tehran, Mr. Fuad Izzati, to offer us more insight on the story. Professor Izzati, welcome to the program. Walk us through the recent comments made by the Iranian president.
Well, as you know, the anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani is just in a few days. And Iran, there are different ceremonies, commemorations, and the idea that President Rouhani mentioned today is something that he has said before, that Iran will do more than just attack an American base in Iraq in terms of responding to that assassination. There are other measures that Iranian leaders are thinking about, and they decide to take those measures at the time that they choose. That's the basic idea. The only problem that we have here is that there are some people in Washington that think that because President Rouhani is very much interested in the nuclear agreement, because he has put a lot of his own personal prestige online to support the nuclear agreement, if there is an attack on Iran in the next few weeks while Trump is still in office, President Rouhani will oppose responding to that type of attack. And that's a big mistake, I think. If someone in Washington thinks in these lines, they're making a huge mistake, because I think Iran, if attacked, will respond to any attack. And the assassination of General Soleimani is something that people think about, and they're sort of itching for some sort of military confrontation from the other side, and the response that Iran will have would be quite severe. And people are worried that in the next 3 weeks or so, while Trump is still in office, would there be a military confrontation or not? I think if there is one from the other side, Iran will respond, and the response would be quite severe.
Well, what about the issue of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani? The president warned that Iranians, first of all, will not forget it, and that they'll take revenge at an appropriate time. What is an appropriate time and an appropriate measure, in your opinion?
You know, I'm not in the government, and I'm not in the military, so it, my opinion really doesn't count. But I do know that Iran is not done with what Iran has done with regard to responding to the assassination of General Soleimani. When the Iranian government decides to respond more, what those measures will be, I think we just have to wait and see. The only thing that I think we have to remember is that in the next 3 weeks, if the U.S. government decides to engage in any military confrontation with Iran, the sense that idea of revenging for the assassination of General Soleimani is still very much present in the minds of Iranian leaders, they would respond to that military attack in a severe way for two reasons. One, because they were attacked by the other side, and second, as a measure to respond to the assassination of the general and the revenge that's supposed to come.
All right, thanks a lot. Professor Fouad Izzetti joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Elsewhere, the chief of the Iranian armed forces says avenging the U.S. assassination of the country's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, will not expire. In a message on the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi said, the 3rd of January reminds us of a bitter incident in the history of the Islamic Republic. He said Soleimani was a national and Islamic hero and a great commander who helped strengthen the resistance against the U.S. hegemony and the Zionist regime. Baghdadi stressed that Iran's revenge on the perpetrators of this terroristic crime and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region are unavoidable. The top general said that Iran's armed forces would double their motivation to follow the path of Soleimani. The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, General Qasem Soleimani, is just around the corner. Correspondent in Afghanistan has talked to a number of people there about the assassination. Let's take a listen.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has not largely affected Iran's regional policies. The U.S. had thought that it could challenge Iran by assassinating the general, but it failed to do so. Likewise, the Islamic Republic has pressed ahead with its policies in the region.
General Soleimani was a key figure in combating terrorism and had a very active role in this regard. The United States assassinated him because it was aware of that fact.
1 year has passed since General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated, but his killing has failed to weaken Iran and impact its regional policies.
The U.S. killed Soleimani to deal a heavy blow to Iran, but it has failed to achieve its goal. The U.S. carries out such actions to serve its own interests, regardless of which country it is dealing with.
Welcome back. The U.S. president's pardoning of American contractors implicated in the Iraq killings has angered the United Nations with a group of its rights experts, saying the move undermines international law. During the news review show, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
And joining us now for this news review is Frank Emspach, emeritus professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Tony Gosley, investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Madison, Wisconsin, with you, Frank. Happy New Year, Merry Christmas. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your thoughts on this on these pardons?
Well, the United States has never agreed to be subject legally to the jurisdiction of the United Nations or the various criminal courts that exist. For example, we have, we've said that very specifically. So from the United States point of view, we're not subject to anything, and they've made that abundantly clear over many, many years. This is not the first criminal, war crimes criminal issue. I mean, we can start with Vietnam, with the Bertrand Russell war crimes tribunals, which were held in Sweden. The United States simply, you know, shrugged it off, even though clearly the issues were a really immense use of gas, phosphorus, all kinds of terrible reagents upon the people in Vietnam. This is a continuation of that, because the United States have never recognized the sovereignty, or never recognized the impact of the national or international war crimes standards. We've just never done that. So when you talk about humanitarian law, that's something that the U.S. government talks about all the time, but only from the U.S. government's point of view, and has never recognized the international standards. This is a serious matter, though. You alluded to it earlier in the broadcast, that the United States is engaged in various things which the rest of the world considers to be in violation of human rights. For instance, the blockade against Cuba for many, many years, the blockade in Yemen, the refusal of the United States to adhere to the treaty that signed with Vietnam after the Vietnamese War in terms of demining and Agent Orange and things like that. So this is a consistent aspect of United States foreign policy, and one that's extremely troubling. I don't mean to make light of this. The many, many people here, the religious community, all kinds of peace advocates, even members of Congress, recognize that walking away from international law weakens the moral authority, whatever's left of it at this point, of the United States. And that one would hope that the Biden administration would go in a different direction. I don't see anything in the current Biden appointees where they would move towards agreeing or signing on to the International Criminal Court. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do anything about it. But it is true that the United States has walked away from these obligations over many, many years.
Thank you, Frank. And Tony, it seems like we possibly may have your sound fixed. If you can hear me now, happy holidays, Tony. Now, Tony, it's one thing to try to, you know, impede an investigation of, you know, ICC prosecutors that want to probe war crimes, possibly in Afghanistan. It's a whole nother animal when you're pardoning private contractors that at a a busy square in the middle of town, get out of the cars, open up on women and children, killing 14, and then you got one guy, you know, basically convicted of first-degree murder and three of manslaughter. Now they're all home hanging out playing PlayStation for the holidays. Tell me your initial thoughts on this story.
Well, in a way, this is worse than terrorism, isn't it? I mean, you've got basically a bunch of young men signed up to a private army. Now, what is a private army? If I wanted to start my own private army here in the UK, I'd probably come into some trouble. Except this is the vector that NATO and the Western governments are now using in order to excuse their own military from service. So when the situation gets tough politically in a particular part of the world, that what they'll do is they'll send in these private, basically mercenaries, to do these jobs. Now, I mean, if Trump was in any kind of wonder boy, like a lot of people seem to paint him out to be, you know, the people who are stuck in this either Biden or Trump, you know, dichotomy, which is really an illusion, you know, because the deep state is going to stay in power before and after Trump and Biden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Edward Snowden. I would like to see him pardoning somebody like Chelsea Manning or Julian Assange. We're all very much wanting that here in the UK, waiting, listening, Trump. Who are you? You know, are you? He's got nothing to lose by doing these things. He would get an enormous cachet around the world, but he doesn't do that. He pardons a bunch of basically thugs, and that's all these people were. They weren't even very proficient terrorists. They were just taking random shots for their own amusement, killing people in the streets in Iraq. And I think it's also worth looking a bit more at this private army, because they keep changing their name, don't they? Blackwater, Eric Prince is Blackwater. We've got, by the way, someone in the Biden administration is very close to the Prince, and there was one in the Trump administration too. So they're going to be being used by as private contractors into the Biden administration. I've no doubt about that too. But if you go to Nigeria, you'll find lots of very good evidence that Boko Haram in Nigeria has been basically run by XE, FSG, or whatever you want to call them, Academy Blackwater. As I say, they keep changing their name. And then when you go a little bit closer to Tehran, to Somalia, back in 2010, Al-Shabaab in Somalia released a press release and had a press conference where they said Blackwater is in this country and it's recruiting people for a terrorist campaign that it's going to try and blame on Islamists and Islamic people. They released that press release. A guy by the name of Sheikh Ali Deir released that, and by 2014 he'd been assassinated by a drone. So what we're seeing here is these private armies, particularly Blackwater, being used to create not only terrorism, but also to try to blame that terrorism on Islamist groups and to try and get Muslims blamed for what actually a private money in America is doing. And also, called people like Oliver North, when he was in charge over there, he was using drug money to pay for this kind of thing. And I'm quite certain that sort of thing still goes on. So these massive slush funds are built up, and deniable operations, mercenaries have been paid for decades now by the United States with a nod and a wink. And that, I think, is why it's so disgusting to see Trump pardoning these people. These are the very people the world could rest easier if they were in jail. But no, they're the ones to be pardoned, not the likes of Assange, Manning, or Snowden.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both. Happy holidays. Thank you for joining us. And Frank Amsbach from Madison, Wisconsin, and Tony Gosling there joining us out of Bristol. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye. For
elsewhere, the United States has registered a record high of more than 3,900 daily deaths from the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. The latest figure brings the old country's overall death toll from the virus to nearly 342,000. Total infections also rise by nearly 190,000 to over 19.7 million. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. Health officials have warned that the country is yet to witness the worst, with the death toll rising at an alarming rate in winter months and after New Year holidays. December has already dethroned April as the nation's deadliest month of COVID-19. Well, a nurse in the U.S. state of California has tested positive for COVID-19 over a week after receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. The 45-year-old nurse identified as Matthew W. works at two different hospitals in San Diego. He said he received the vaccine on December 18th and did not suffer any side effects. However, he said he became sick on Christmas Eve after a shift in the COVID-19 unit. The drug maker said in a statement that it would review all available information on the case and all reports of any confirmed diagnosis following the vaccination. Pfizer said the vaccine provides some protection against COVID-19 within about 10 days of the first dose and substantially boosted after the second dose. A U.S. Republican senator says he will contest Congress's next week's certification of the Electoral College vote. Josh Hawley of Missouri stressed he was objecting to the confirmation because of concerns about election integrity. He added that Congress should investigate allegations of voter fraud. Hawley is the first senator to publicly confirm plans to object to the November 3rd election results. His move will force lawmakers in both the House and Senate to vote on whether to accept the results. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House, said Hawley's move would come to nothing. Joe Biden beat incumbent Donald Trump 306 to 232 in the Electoral College. Trump has refused to concede, citing election fraud. He's called for a rally in Washington on January the 6th to pressure lawmakers not to certify Biden's win. Venezuela's Supreme Court has ruled that a move by the opposition-controlled National Assembly to extend its term an additional year was invalid. The ruling paves the way for allies of President Nicolas Maduro to take over the body next month. Opposition leader Juan Guaido's allies tried to extend the assembly's term after the ruling Socialist Party won a major score during the general vote earlier this month. The opposition had boycotted the vote. The U.S.-backed Guaido has repeatedly failed in his attempts to overthrow the government. He was the National Assembly Speaker until January, when his fellow lawmakers ousted him from his post. He was later stripped of his immunity. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth.
Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The best chance that many South Africans have to get vaccinated anytime soon is to volunteer for a clinical trial and test unproven coronavirus vaccines on their bodies. But that arrangement has raised ethical questions. First is whether countries like South Africa, which is supporting trials by four drug makers, should be guaranteed doses if the trials succeed. The government hasn't received such a guarantee. At any rate, such an arrangement would be ethically murky, since it would punish countries that participate in unsuccessful trials. We now present you an article written jointly by Matt Apuzzo and Selam Gebrekidan. The piece is titled, "For COVID-19 Vaccines, Some Are Too Rich and Too Poor." The article was published by the New York Times. Stay with us for more of Matt Apuzzo and Selam Gebrekidan's article. A few months from now, a factory in South Africa is expected to begin churning out 1 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine each day in the African country hardest hit by the pandemic. But those vials will probably be shipped to a distribution center in Europe and then rushed to Western countries that have pre-ordered them by the hundreds of millions. None have been set aside for South Africa itself. The country, which will help manufacture the vaccine and whose citizens have enrolled in clinical trials, does not expect to see the first trickle of doses until around the middle of next year. By then, the United States, Britain, and Canada may already have vaccinated more than 100 million people. The first year of the COVID-19 pandemic revealed that a country's wealth would not spare it from the virus. Overconfidence, poor planning, and ignored warnings felled some of the world's richest nations. But now, money is translating into undeniable advantages. Over the past few months, rich nations like the United States and Britain have cut deals with multiple drug manufacturers and secured enough doses to vaccinate their citizens multiple times over. China and Russia have conducted their own trials and begun mass vaccination programs. Yet countries like South Africa are in a singular bind because they cannot hold out hope for charity. Although its government is nearly insolvent and half of its citizens live in poverty, South Africa is considered too rich to qualify for cut-rate vaccines from international aid organizations. Salim Abdulkarim, an epidemiologist who leads the country's Coronavirus Advisory Council, said, "Where you're not rich enough, but you're not poor enough, you're stuck." Poor and middle-income nations, largely unable to compete in the open market, rely on a complex vaccine-sharing scheme called COVAX. A collaboration of international health organizations, COVAX was designed to avoid the inequities of a free market free-for-all. But its deals come with strings attached, and health advocates are questioning its transparency and accountability. By the middle of next year, South African officials hope to secure their first vaccine doses under the COVAX program, even as they negotiate to buy supplemental supplies from drug manufacturers. But in a country where luxury estates are walled off from sprawling squatter villages, many expect the newest vaccines to remain a privilege for residents who can pay out of pocket or through supplemental insurance, a program that disproportionately benefits white people. The best chance that many South Africans have to get vaccinated anytime soon is to volunteer for a clinical trial and test unproven vaccines on their bodies. But the arrangement has raised ethical questions. First is whether countries like South Africa, which is supporting trials by four drug makers, should be guaranteed doses of vaccines if the trials succeed. The government hasn't received such a guarantee, and at any rate, such an arrangement would be ethically murky, because it would punish countries that participate in unsuccessful trials. In the 1990s, when antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV were developed, South Africans volunteered for clinical trials, knowing that they could never afford the medicine otherwise. Dr. Venter said, "If you had money, you were able to buy it. If you didn't, you died." He added, "It's going to be the same thing again." COVAX was set up to prevent that. It came together with money and support from the World Health Organization, WHO, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Countries, even those that cannot hope to compete on the open market, can buy into COVAX and receive vaccines. Poor countries pay nothing. South African medical advisers say the COVAX system is vital but also deeply frustrating. Governments must pay up front without knowing what vaccine they will receive or getting any guarantees on when the doses will arrive. COVAX estimates the price per dose but offers little recourse if the cost is ultimately much higher. Countries must assume all of the risk if the vaccine fails or if anything goes wrong. During a recent call with reporters, COVAX officials called their vaccine sharing program the only global solution to this pandemic. Seth Berkley, the chief executive of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, said, "We still need more doses, and yes, we still need more money, but we have a clear pathway to securing the initial 2 billion doses of vaccine and then beyond that." Still, Seth Berkley and other officials declined to reveal their arrangements with drug companies, describing them as company secrets. They also did not make public the deals they have struck with individual countries. Fatima Hassan, a human rights lawyer, said, "They're agreeing to buy something with public money, and we won't have any influence on pricing." Fatima Hassan added, "COVAX is saying the pricing is fair, but we don't know. Where's the transparency?" Those trade-offs might be palatable for countries receiving the medicine nearly free, but South Africa is paying about $140 million for its COVAX doses to vaccinate roughly 10% of its population, including healthcare workers and some high-risk people. The South African government hopes to cover the country's remaining 50 million people through private deals with drug companies. Globally, the process is secretive, with governments not disclosing the prices that they are paying for vaccines. When a Belgian minister recently published the European Union's price list, she revealed that prices vary depending on who's doing the buying. Many South Africans are deeply skeptical of pharmaceutical companies and wary of government corruption. The health minister, Zweli Mkhize, said in a recent call with reporters that it was essential that rich countries not hoard vaccines, but otherwise the government has said little about its plans. Outraged, health advocates have threatened to sue the country's government to make the plans public. Ultimately, though, money is the great differentiator. From the outset, South Africa's government knew it could not afford to order doses before they were tested and approved, as wealthy countries did. South Africa has seen this play out before, Back in 2009, when the world feared a devastating H1N1 flu outbreak, rich countries hoarded the earliest vaccines. While the outbreak was far weaker than expected, it revealed the inequities that exist when countries compete for life-saving medicine. For the COVID-19 vaccine, government officials and advisors say they have met with or received preliminary inquiries from most of the major pharmaceutical companies. Abdul Karim, the head of the country's coronavirus council, said the country needed to be judicious in choosing a vaccine that best fits the needs of South Africans. For example, rushing to buy the Pfizer vaccine, which requires shipping and storage at ultra-cold temperatures, made no sense at all when cheaper, simpler, and more manageable medicines were on the horizon. But because South Africa did not pre-order doses from private companies, the country may have to watch its own domestic drug makers, Aspen Pharmacare, produce vaccines for other countries before they are available domestically. Under contract with Johnson & Johnson, the South African drug maker Aspen is expected to produce millions of vaccine doses. South African officials have high hopes for the vaccine, which does not need cold storage and promises to require one injection rather than two. Ms. Hassan said, "We'll participate in your trials, we'll manufacture your vaccines, but we don't know if we'll get access." Johnson & Johnson has promised to sell its vaccines at break-even prices and provide half a billion doses to COVAX to help poor countries. Aspen's chief executive, Stephen Saad, said he was proud of that commitment, but he acknowledged that there is no guarantee for South Africa. Stephen Saad said, "It's Johnson & Johnson's decision as to where the product goes." South Africa, which has now passed a million COVID-19 cases, is facing its second wave. Public health officials are particularly worried about a new mutation of coronavirus that they believe may have made the virus more contagious. In poor and working-class neighborhoods, the greater fear is for a new lockdown. The government's earlier lockdown devastated the economy and confined many South Africans to tin shacks built on arm's length apart, with a dozen families sharing an outhouse and many more sharing a water tap. Mizwan Madoda, who was selected for a drug trial, said, "It's impossible to have social distancing here in South Africa." He's counting on the vaccine, hoping he got the actual medicine and not a placebo. He said, "I want my life back." Mizwan Madoda woke up the day after his injection feeling well. He talked it over with his wife, and they decided that she would walk to Dr. Gill's clinic and enroll that weekend. A few days later, though, Dr. Gill got word that Johnson & Johnson did not need any new test subjects at her location. Data was pouring in, a good outcome, but that meant that when people began lining up at the gates early that morning, she had to turn them away.
Debate.
Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have held their first joint military drills since the year 2014. They held the drill to unveil their military capabilities and equipment. Now, the immediate question that arises is, why are they holding the drills at this time? Is there something in the works, or is it simply a show of force, resistance, and preparation against their enemy, Israel? In this edition of the debate, we will zoom in on these two questions and find out from our guests where the situation may end up.
In an incident considered the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, the joint chamber of the Palestinian resistance factions held its first large-scale joint military drill over the past years. During the one-day military exercise, Palestinian groups unveiled some of their military capabilities and equipment.
The Palestinian resistance groups showed their unity in this joint military exercise. The drill is aimed at showing the improvement of the resistance capabilities. It sends this message to the Israeli enemy that we are capable of facing any aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The drill consisted of simulation of ground and air military operations, during which several rockets were fired toward the sea.
We believe that the unity of all Palestinian groups is the only way to improve our strength and capabilities in order to face the Israeli regime. It shows how strong we have become in our struggle against the occupation.
Today, the resistance groups sent a strong message to the Israeli army that the Palestinian resistance is capable of defending Palestinians against any aggression. It also showed how united they are in their resistance.
Since 2008, Israel has waged three wars against Gaza, where 2 million Palestinians live under a 12-year Israeli blockade from air, sea, and land. Thousands of Gazans have been killed in each of these deadly wars. The Palestinian resistance groups say they hold the drills to show their military capabilities as well as unity in fight against the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Moti Abu Musabe, who's a Palestinian political activist, joining us from Gaza City. And we also have Khalid Barakat, who's a journalist and activist, joining us from Vancouver. I'd like to welcome you both. Moti Abu Musabe, let me first start with you and ask you a straightforward question. Why the Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip are holding their first joint military drill, something that hasn't happened since the year 2014, the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me here once again. And actually, if we want to talk about this military drill implemented by the Palestinian military factions here in the Gaza Strip, I think we need to focus and shed the light on the messages that the Palestinian factions wanted to send to different parties, actually, at the same time. And I think the first one and the most important message was directed to the Israeli occupation and the Israeli leaders, especially in these political conditions and the political deadlocks that those leaders are experiencing on the Israeli arena. We all realize and we all know that the Israeli leaders used to maneuver and evade their internal political deadlocks and the crisis by attacking the Palestinian territories in order to export those political deadlocks and the crisis. So the clear message for the Israeli leaders was that the Palestinian resistance factions are well prepared to confront and to resist any Israeli aggression and offense against the population of the Gaza Strip. The clear message also was that the Palestinian resistance would never allow for the Israeli leaders to invest and to exploit and to use the Palestinian blood as a winning card to achieve their political aims at the expense of the Palestinian people. So I think that the message was clear to the Israeli occupation that the situation here is nowadays is different, and any decision and making such a decision of attacking Gaza is different from any other precedent decisions today. Any attack and any offense against Gaza Strip would never be a picnic for the Israeli soldiers. This, I think, was the first one. Secondly, I think that the Palestinian resistance factions through this military drill reminded the whole world and the international community that it is still turning a blind eye to the Israeli ongoing perpetual crimes against the Palestinian people, that the Palestinians that the Palestinians have the mere right to defend themselves against that Israeli crime.
Okay, very well. Let's move on to Khalid Barakat. Khalid Barakat, so our guest was zooming in amongst many points that he made about the reaction that Israel is going to have on this. We're looking at 12 Palestinian armed groups that actually held these drills, firing rockets into the Mediterranean, launching drones in the airspace. We saw rockets being fired, and of course the footage there is testament to the depth of what was executed. Do you think that, well, what message will that send to Israel, in your opinion, and do you think that that would change Israel's calculations when they, and if they want to attack Gaza, as they have done so many times, including obviously the three major wars?
Yes, I think that the message is that the Palestinian resistance is sending to Israel and other parties as well, is that the internal Palestinian front in Gaza is united, and the Palestinian resistance factions and forces are united in confronting any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that these Palestinian military drills and exercises comes at the anniversary of the massacre that took place in 2008 when Israel launched a full-scale aggression against the people in Gaza in 2008, what they called Casled, and it resulted in killing more than 1,400 Palestinians, the destruction of thousands of houses, killing more than 430 Palestinian children, even the destruction of some of UN facilities, hospitals, mosques, and so on and so forth. So this message to Israel is that we, Palestinian resistance, are ready and alert, and they will respond against any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that also in that time, Obama was getting ready to be in the White House, very similar situation to what we see today with Biden, and Israel used deception at that time in order to launch a sudden attack against people in Gaza. The first day of that aggression resulted on the killing of more than 200 Palestinians. And so the resistance wants to send a message that we are alert, we are united, and at the same time, it is a message to the normalization camp and the defeated camp in the region that Gaza, despite the siege that it's been placed under for more than 12 years now, the capabilities of the Palestinian resistance is not, you know, you cannot compare it to 2008. Today, they're united, they're strong, and not just the Palestinian resistance, but resisting camp in the region as well are united and alert.
Okay, so Moti, let's look at another outcome out of this one-day drill that has come out, and that is that obviously, aside from the unity that is shown amongst these Palestinian factions, we're also looking at how they have said that perhaps this lack of Palestinian reconciliation and the normalization of relations with Israel by some Arab countries is another message that this sends out. Do you agree with that?
Yes, actually, beside what your guest has mentioned, and beside what was mentioned by throughout the report, I think the message was clear that despite, especially in these hard circumstances and this hard time that the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause is experiencing, and actually we all are witnessing the cruel attempts of the surrounding Arab regimes to liquidate the Palestinian cause and end the Palestinian rights nowadays. So I think the timing of this drill is key and important, that despite all those shameful and disgraceful agreements that aim to liquidate the Palestinian cause in favor of the Israeli occupation, in return for some investments here or there, and actually the message was clear, that despite all of that, Palestinians would never allow to relinquish their rights to drop their weapons or to raise the white flag. Yes, those normalization agreements constituted a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and abandoned the Palestinian people alone in front of the criminal Israeli occupation, but the Palestinians, despite all of that, would never drop their weapon and would never surrender for the Israeli occupation. I think this this is a clear message in this time exactly. The second message is, was that despite the failure of the conciliation negotiation between the Palestinian faction, the real unity translated on the ground and expressed by the and was expressed by the such a military drill, which constituted a clear has delivered a clear message that the real unity is in the field and the Palestinian military, and there is a wide consensus among the Palestinians that the resistance choice is the mere choice for them to regain their rights and to have their rights again,
okay,
of living in dignity and freedom.
Okay, Khaled Barakat, this comes at a time when just recently, a day or two ago, we had the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, that said that Israel had threatened to hit one of its facilities, and the Secretary General said that, well, you know, if you do that, we have, first of all, twice as many precision-guided missiles as a year ago, and we have the capability with these missiles to hit all of Palestine and all of Israel, the occupied territories. Then you have the Palestinian factions that executed this one-day military exercise, which is very large-scale and one of its kind. So we can see that the resistance front is very strong. Is there a connection here? And also, again, if I was Israel and I'm looking at these events, I would think twice about any military adventurism that perhaps they might want to do or go ahead with.
Absolutely. And we see that the unity of the resistance camp in the region is more strong today than any other time in the last 10 years. The coordination and the level of cooperation between the resistance in Lebanon and the Palestinian resistance, with the support of Iran and Syria, and the popular support, the wide popular support that the resistance enjoy. We see that the Palestinian people across the board, whether in Palestine or in exile and diaspora, looks at the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanese resistance as a one front. And we see the vast popular support that these exercises are getting. Now, the challenge really is the political challenge, the internal political challenges, whether in Lebanon or in Palestine, and nearly and more importantly, the political front. We see that the weak link in Palestine is the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. This is a force, a reactionary force that is now trying to send messages to the Biden administration that they're ready to go back to negotiations and security cooperation with Israel. Today in Palestine, we see these two camps very clearly, the camp of resistance and the camp of, the Palestinian Authority and security cooperation. So in Lebanon, the interview, the comprehensive interview that General Secretary of Hezbollah, Said Hassan Nasrallah, gave the interview of the year, he pointed out that the capabilities of the resistance in Lebanon in the last since 2006 battle until today, we see that how the capabilities is absolutely mounted and is more strong than before. Also, in a few days it will be the anniversary of the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and the crime that the United States have committed against Iran and Iraq by assassinating a general who played central role in supporting both the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance. So it is, in a way, a message to the enemy, but at the same time, it is a message of solidarity and unity.
Okay, since you've touched on that there, Khaled Barkat, I'm going to ask our guest there from Gaza City. You know, we are looking at this one-year anniversary, and Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was very symbolic for the Palestinians who looked at his martyrdom and the way that he was assassinated very deeply, that he was somebody who sacrificed his life for the for Palestine, for Jerusalem al-Quds, and obviously supported the Palestinian resistance. We're looking again at this, the focus of our debate, which is this one-day military exercise. And you know, there's lots of notions that there's going to be retaliation that may occur as a result. Do you think, therefore, that there is a connection here, that this anniversary is coming up, and you have this one-day military exercise that happened in the Gaza Strip? Mut Abu Masada.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Actually, there is a strong connection between these two topics, and this there is a clear message that the Palestinians realize the role that Qasem Soleimani has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance here in the Gaza Strip, and we cannot neglect or ignore such a role that the martyr Qasem Soleimani has played. It has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance. Yes, the clear message, I think that despite all the cruel attempts and despite all the attacks and all the clampdown against the resistance pivot here in the region, that the resistance front, either it was in Palestine, in Gaza, or in Lebanon, or in any other place, is still strong against the Israeli occupation and the United States.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. We're going to end it there. Let me thank our guest. You were just listening to Moti Abu Musaba, Palestinian political activist there from Gaza City, and Khaled Barkat, a pleasure to have you, journalists and activists from Vancouver. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tagli, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
An important point in this respect is that regarding the domestic issues of the country, well, most comments about him are about his regional battles and activities. Shahid Soleimani did not belong to any party and faction, but at the same time, he was a revolutionary in the complete sense of the word. The revolution and being revolutionary were his definite red lines. Some people should not try to undermine this aspect of his personality. This is a reality about him. He was absorbed by the revolution, and being a revolutionary was his red line. Of course, he was not interested in aligning himself with different parties, different factions, and the like, but he was completely committed to the idea of being a revolutionary. He was committed to the revolution and to the auspicious and dazzling guidelines of our late Imam, may God bestow paradise on him.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing nor I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
One example of his insight and his courage was that the enemies might know this well, but some friends might not know it, is that he managed to foil all illegitimate plots of the Americans in West Asia with the help of regional peoples, or it could be said with the support that he offered to them. That man managed to stand up to all the plots that had been hatched with money, with vast propaganda efforts made by the Americans, with the diplomatic capabilities of the Americans, and with the bullying that they exert on politicians, particularly on some weak countries. He managed to foil all the schemes set up by them in West Asia. Regarding Palestine, the Americans intended to consign the issue of Palestine to oblivion and to keep the Palestinians weak so that they would not dare speak of fighting. But that man empowered the Palestinians. He did something to make a small region like the Gaza Strip, which is a small strip of land, stand up to the Zionist regime despite all their extravagant claims. He created such a disastrous situation for them that they asked for ceasefire after just 48 hours. This was done by Haj Qasem Soleimani.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.